Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of April the 1st, 2019. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. From Phoenix, Arizona, this is Ed Zollers, and I'm going to be talking to you some about what happened this week in various items on taxes, including IRS announcements regarding GM vehicles and the electric vehicle tax credit. The IRS gave formal guidance on how state income tax refunds are going to be taxed next year, after this year's $10,000 cap. We also found that the SALT workaround proposed regulations have gone final, or at least they're going to the OIRA for purposes of determining how the final regulations will read, so we're probably not far away from finding out how that's going to work. The IRS made changes to requirements to obtain an employer identification number. They're going to require the responsible person to have a Social Security number or an ITIN. And the final regulations were published this week on reportable transaction law changes that took place back in 2010. We finally got those regulations out. Well, it's springtime and we're into the, as we said, the first games of the baseball season have begun. And that also means we're hitting here the end of tax season. You'll be glad to know it is April Fool's starting this week. But yeah, unfortunately, nothing we're going to talk about here this week is actually a joke. Despite how you may feel about some of it, it's all basically what's happening right now. So we'll talk about that. But in any event, it is spring. It is time for us to be heading to the very end of the initial part of tax season. We have the regular part of tax season with those people who are not extended. And then we'll deal with our extension friends later. So baseball begins and tax season comes to its close. Well, a couple of things I want to talk to you about the online discussion groups, discussions that have gone on this week. I like to clarify this a little bit, go over it, because I think this is a useful resource for those of you who have access to these things. In discussions among CPAs on tax issues, again, probably the top topic continues to be issues related to Section 199 Cap A. That's been the issue all tax season. It continues to be our key issue. There's still a lot of confusion going around about the rentals, and the issue regarding the safe harbor seems to be causing a lot of concern. People seem to be very confused about what the safe harbor is, what it isn't, what it means, and how to interpret it. One thing I think we have to be very clear about is the safe harbor is just what it says it is. It is not a set of rules that tell you how this section is to be applied in all cases. Rather, as a Treasury official noted, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, the safe harbor is meant only for simple cases that are easy to handle, that basically the IRS is going to give you a very straightforward, simple answer in the simplest of cases. It's important not to read the requirements to come under the safe harbor as being requirements to have a trade or business for rentals. They're not meant to be that. They are meant just to be, they said, look, if your case is really, really simple, and really easy, you have like four residential rentals or four commercial rentals for that matter, and you spend more than 250 hours in them during the year, and you keep decent books, that's kind of helpful, then we're going to go ahead and say, yeah, they're not a triple net lease. We're going to say, yeah, that's a trade or business. We're not going to challenge you on it. And that's really all the safe harbor says. The safe harbor says nothing about whether or not any other non-simple structure is or is not a trade or business. It says nothing about rentals that don't meet the safe harbor requirements, except you can't use the safe harbor to claim they're a trade or business. The other confusion we get consistently, it continues to happen, I mentioned it here, there seems to be a lot of confusion about the aggregation rules of Reg 1.199 Cap A-4 and the safe harbor. First thing to note, the safe harbor did not exist when the aggregation rules first came up last summer in August. We have had regulations on the aggregation rules for months. They had nothing to do with the safe harbor, and in fact, they do not apply in any way, shape, or form to the safe harbor. Why? Aggregation, which is a technical term, it's important to understand, just as passive activity is a technical term, not to be used in its general context. We talk about 469 and the passive activity loss rules and the restrictions. Same thing is true when we use the word aggregation here. So you got to be very careful when you're talking about what we're doing. Aggregation only takes place after, underline that about three times, after you've already determined you have trades or businesses. If you have not yet determined if something is a trade or business, you absolutely cannot yet touch the aggregation rules. Second, the safe harbor rules have these things called enterprises. Enterprises look like aggregation, but they're not. They're totally different. Because the safe harbor only matters if we're not yet sure if we have a trade or business. We're trying to figure out if we have a trade or business. So we don't even have a trade or business yet. So we absolutely cannot use aggregation because that's not allowed. Remember, aggregation is the technical term. Please be very careful here. Aggregation is a technical term. You got to be very careful that when you aggregate, you know, you're not talking about aggregating here. We're combining. And I have to use, that's why I use weird terms when I talk about combining undertakings into an enterprise, because we don't know it's a trade or business, you know, and we're not, I don't use the word aggregation because that has a very technical meaning, which does not absolutely does not apply here. So we aggregate that we get enterprises. Once we have an enterprise, that may be a trade or business. If that's a trade or business, then and only then we can look at aggregating that with other trades or businesses. But you do not use the four rules plus the three additional rules on aggregation to determine whether something is going to be an enterprise for rentals. And rentals are not totally governed by the safe harbor rules. Okay. That's probably been the biggest confusion we've had to date. We also continue to have some issues with pass-through entities and how the rules work there. We had discussion this week on one forum about working interest for oil and gas and the quirky nature because they're kind of a partnership, right? We had that ruling going back in the Methven case that they were a partnership that had opted out. So they had to be treated for self-employment tax purposes as a trade or business. And, you know, does that impact them here? I think it probably does. But obviously the regs don't directly discuss it. So that gets kind of interesting. But yes, I think most people believe, and I think the IRS believes, that working interests qualify for 199 Cap A, but royalty interests probably don't. And if you're in oil and gas, there's a big difference in those two. We also had a discussion early in the week on clients that come in the door with too good to be true tax deals. You know, their friend, they got promoted something by a friend, and a friend's accountant or a friend's CPA. You do realize that most people who are not in this business think of anybody that does taxes, they'll call them a CPA. So never assume somebody is a CPA just because your client says some CPA said this. You have to kind of double check that to be true because they'll do it. And they say, look, we've got this deal, and apparently I can put $10,000 in, and I will get $10,000 immediate reduction in taxes through all these wonderful credits, and it works great. And, you know, and the guy who's doing it says that it does, you know, it's been approved by the IRS, and they've got approval, et cetera. And you're asked, well, does this work? And you're presented with this thing that just does not appear to work, because your theory was, and the case in question was talking about some solar energy issues, was, well, if this worked as well as they're saying, and of course, you got a couple of problems that the client probably got it wrong. And secondly, these things are being promoted in a way that probably shouldn't be. But if it really was that great, nobody would be talking about enterprise zones. It'd be just, there wouldn't be any point. You'd be doing this. So you have to do that. When faced with that, a couple things I think you need to be aware of. First thing is, do not fall for the fallacy of prove it does not exist. Prove it doesn't. The initial burden is on the party asserting it works. When a client comes in and says, you know, my buddy says, his CPA says you can invest in this thing and you put $10,000 in, you reduce your taxes by $20,000. You got to say, okay, fine. You know, give me the analysis from the promoter telling me why this works. What exactly the legal analysis, preferably a legal opinion, that tells me why this works. It is not my job to prove that every crazy off-the-wall idea that might exist doesn't work. The party asserting the thing works has the burden of proving it works. So always fall for that. You're not following, say, go down that path. The other problem we run into in this case, you need to be very careful, is remind clients that if they go along with, let's say they say, well, I'm going to go to that other CPA because he's doing it. And, you know, that other CPA happens to be the guy promoting the practice, this other quote CPA, may or may not be one. It's like, please remember that we've got the history here in penalties. You cannot rely on advice from somebody who is effectively promoting the transaction in question, who's a promoter. The client needs to understand that, You know, if in fact I said, well, look, I'm a CPA. Let's assume that other guy is a CPA. Let's assume we both, you know, so you got two CPAs here, and I'll admit you client, you have no idea, no way to tell the difference in the two of us. But here's the catch. Since I'm not being paid based on whether this transaction happens or not, if you ask me for an opinion, if you give me all the information and I agree to give you my advice on this topic, you will be able to at least insulate yourself from penalties if it turns out the advice I give you is wrong. As long as you've checked, make sure it appears that I should know what I'm doing. You've checked my history. I've been in taxes, you know, for 30 some years. I've been doing this, you know, my background, you know, and based on that, it's fine. And you have no counters. The other party, even if he has everything that I had, the fact that he's a promoter disqualifies him. So bottom line, you need to get somebody who's not going to be paid based on whether this happens or not to give you advice that it works. And until you have that, you don't have protection. So tell him that's fine. Tell him you can go with him, but you better be right. Because if you go with me, if I said it's fine, you go and you work with me because I'm not having anything to do with that. I don't do work with that. Then fine, that works. I said, the other problem you've got is you also can't opinion shop. It's not you keep calling people, you know, go down what used to be the yellow pages. Now, however we do it, we go online, I guess, and find, you know, keep finding accountants in tax. And when you finally get somebody who will do it, then you say, yeah, I'll follow him. Reasonable people would understand that if it took you 10 tries to find somebody who said it was okay, there's a reasonable chance it's not okay. That's your problem. So it's always kind of fun. And these sorts of things crop up this time of year. Now let's get to developments. First thing is notice 2019-22 issued on March the 26th. The IRS announced that General Motors now has exceeded 200,000 vehicles that qualify for the electric vehicle credit. They exceeded those sales in the quarter ended December 31st, 2018. Because of that, we're going to begin to phase out the credit. The credit reduces beginning April 1st, this week. It reduces down to one half of the normal. So instead of 7,500, if somebody got their sale closed by March 31st, then $7,500 is their credit. If that same deal closes April 1st, the credit's going to be only $3,750 on a qualified vehicle. And that $3,750 level applies through the end of September of this year. From October 1st of this year through March 31st of next year, and that should be March 31st, 2020, for those of you who are watching online, who are watching the video and see the slides, it says 19. But that'll be $1,875 for the second 6 months. We get to April 1st of 2020, there will be no credit given for a GM electric vehicle. You may remember that last quarter we had Tesla was the one that cleared. They cleared the end of September, so then it became the end of December. You were racing to get Teslas to get to 7,500. Now the GM qualified vehicles, we're going to be racing for the next year to qualify those. The IRS did something really nice for us this week. Revenue ruling 2019-11 issued on March the 29th, 2019. A few weeks back on this program, we talked about the issue of how would a state income tax refund be taxed next year? Because there'd been a lot of confusion regarding how that would happen. And in fact, one major software vendor, Lacert, had been computing the amount of refund that was going to be taxable, according to reports that I've received, basing on a proration. If you know, we said, hey, you know, what portion of your total taxes were refunded? And then using that to determine how much of the refund would be taxable. And they worked that out based on the 10,000 and ratios and doing various involved computations. And as I said back a couple weeks ago, I said Section 111 of the code makes it pretty clear that's not how it works. IRS and Revenue Ruling 2019-11 confirms that's not how it works. Rather, the tax benefit rules of Section 111 apply in this case. I'm not sure how Intuit came up with their idea of how this is going to work, but it's not. My guess is they were trying to be super conservative, their theory being that it's better to, you know, tell people that they're going to pay tax on more money, and then if they pay tax on less, they're happier. But in any event, it was a problem because people started making decisions based on that. and some decisions that I think turned out to be very flawed based on what they were doing because of their concern about the proration, at least potentially flawed, especially if you drop their taxes below their deduction below 10 grand because you were worried about how this structure would work. So that was kind of the problem. And it could also be a problem if, for instance, say you dropped it below 10 grand and you're in a state that allows a state tax deduction. There's not many that do, but there are some. My home state of Arizona does. And that deduction is not subject to the cap. Well, we don't know if Arizona's is or isn't. That's a whole long discussion. Those of you outside this state need to worry about. But in any event, you know, we could have a problem if you made that election. Do you like go to sales tax to try to avoid this problem? Well, you don't need to avoid it. Section 111, the revenue ruling makes it very clear. 111A controls the taxation under the tax benefit rule. That's been in place since day one. The reason why I think people got so worked up over it this year is because most of us, especially those of us who've been working with higher income taxpayers, have never really had to worry too much about that, at least except in the context of the alternative minimum tax, where it gets a little messy and there are ways to, and you do that calculation. But even there, you know, we didn't get too involved. So for a long time, we haven't really worried about it. We've not had many people that were the tax benefit rule came into play for the idea of were they doing, you know, did they just barely qualify to itemize because of their income tax withholding? And then that refund was going to push them below itemization. And that was the old question about the tax benefit rule, when you could have a partially taxable refund prior to AMT issues. So, but that was something you probably dealt with in your undergraduate tax course, you know, individual tax course. And then you spent 25, 30 years never worried about it again. Well, now we got to worry about it. The ruling looks at four different scenarios about how this works. They look at the scenario of in a case where you have your taxes are below the limit and you itemize, and that's pretty much how we've had before, and not surprisingly, in that example, fully taxable. They look at the case where your taxes go above the limit. So let's say you have $15,000 worth of taxes, you get a $2,000 refund and you itemize your way above the standard deduction. Well, that $2,000 refund's non-taxable. It's not going to be included in next year's income. They look at the cases involved with the situation. Well, you know, what happens if I have $11,000 in taxes on Schedule A, but I get a $2,000 refund? Well, in that case, $1,000 of the refund would be considered part of next year's income because you would have gotten the benefit had the IRS on exam. And this way 111 works. Had that been disallowed on exam, they would have reduced your taxable income by $1,000. Why? We'd have gone from $11,000 in taxes, which only allows a $10,000 deduction, to $9,000 in taxes, a $9,000 deduction. Our drop in deduction will be only $1,000. Because of that reduced drop, because that drop in deduction, we are basically only going to be taxed on the $1,000. And finally, they look at the issue where you're over the cap. This kind of an interesting combo. You're over the cap, but you're just barely over the itemization limit. This is probably more likely to happen for a married couple filing a joint return. And you get a refund. Let's say, again, that let's say we're $500 over the cap. That same example I just gave, you had $11,000 in taxes, you got a $2,000 refund. I'm $500 over the cap. Well, the first $1,000 of that refund is not taxable under the logic I gave you before. It doesn't reduce the Schedule A deduction. But now we still reduce the Schedule A deduction $9,000, but here's what happens. Because you're only $5,000 over the standard, only $500 over the standard deduction, only $500 of that part of the refund is going to be considered taxable, because the other $500, we're able to stop the IRS being able to assess more tax because the taxpayer switches to the standard deduction. That's the way it works. There are four specific layouts there, four ways to do it, right? As I noted, Be Careful Tax Software has been publishing, you know, calculations of what'll be taxable next year. That has been an error. Hopefully you've not been telling your clients those numbers, or, you know, you've double checked them, like everything in the tax software this year. Double check and be skeptical of everything. And this was one of those things to double check and be skeptical of, because no, it didn't work that way. It's really no change from the rules we've had in prior years. Now, there is a question, is there ever, because this came up some in a Wall Street Journal article. You know, some people are saying, well, it's still beneficial if you're, you know, if in fact you're just going over the standard deduction limit, right? And you're like in case four. So with the refund, if we then paid in the tax, it gets us to the refund level, we would have used the standard deduction. Well, you should elect to use the standard deduction instead of going down that route. And it's phrased in many cases like that's automatic. It's not automatic. Let's talk about what happens there. And this actually has been around for years. This is not a new analysis. Here's the catch. If I'm 500 over, right, I'm going to get a $1,000 refund. I'm 500 over this year. And I know I'm going to get a $1,000 refund that would be taxable in that 500, which would be taxable in 19. Well, if I don't say use the standard deduction, I'm going to get to reduce my income for 18 by $500. I will have to turn around and pick that up on my 19 return. Normally in tax planning, all things being equal, we like deferral. So yeah, paying the tax a year later, that's generally a good thing. But there are a couple of things to worry about there. First thing is it might not be such a good thing because number one, let's be totally honest, interest rates are fairly low. So your discount rate that justifies why it's better to pay it later gets to be fairly low. The other problem we're into is it's possible your rates might be higher next year. Maybe you know it's going to happen. Now, the flip side of that is it's possible you know your rates are higher this year than next year, in which case then the opposite conclusion, right? So I definitely want to push it to next year. The other potential problem is that the refund does go into AGI. So it could impact anything impacted by AGI. That could include the, you know, medical deduction. Well, most people don't clear that, but still, if they do, it's there. It could affect anything that has a cliff level or has phase outs with AGI. And we know Congress loves that stuff. Probably one that would be closer to be a problem that could kill it off for sure if it applied would be if the taxpayer is subject to the net investment income tax or paying the income tax based on AGI, not investment income. Remember, we have two ways to pay that tax, two things that tax could be computed on. Then, yeah, that could be bad because a 3.8% will be applied on that. While if we just don't get the deduction this year, we'll change taxable income, not AGI. But it's not necessarily a given that, you know, if you're going to go over the standard deduction, you know, if in essence, if next year that refund would push you below, that you would just automatically want to do standard. And it's the same analysis you should have been thinking about before, theoretically, that nobody worried about till this came up. You might consider it. My takeaway is I think the dollars involved are going to be so small that actually the time spent looking for this and the time billed for, you know, the amount of the charge a client will incur for you to do this work is probably going to be more than any benefit they'll get. But nevertheless, that scenario theoretically could work. So just let you know. So if you feel good, that works. Well, more state and local tax issues. The Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, the Office of Management and Budget, their website on March 25th tells us that they received the final regulations on the SALT workarounds, those that came out last summer to deal with the state tax credit, right? They also sent a notice along with regulations. We know nothing about what's in the final regulation or what's in the notice. All we know is that it's gone on to OIRA for approval for final publication. Now, if you remember when we talked about Section 199 Cap A, it took about a month for OIRA to finish their review of that. Again, these are simpler regulations, so it may not take as much time, but I do think there's a very, very good chance that we are not going to see guidance, right, until after tax season. That'll come up. The IRS had asked for guidance in certain areas. You know, they want to know, you know, they talked about if the state said, well, you give $100, and if you get to the right charity, we'll give you a credit, we'll give you a deduction that's equal to five times that. How would we compute the tax benefit? Because the reg suggests we should be doing that. How the de minimis rule works, you know, is 15% the right way to ignore it? And then finally, how could they do a rule that would work that could allow people to say, I don't want the Arizona credit for private school tuition organizations. I want to take my deduction. Is there a way to make that work? Again, we don't know what guidance they, well, we know somewhat what guidance they got. We see comments, but what the IRS is going to do with that guidance is open. And we have no idea what this notice is going to be about. We do know it's fairly likely, though, we're not going to find this till after tax season ends. My suspicion is the IRS is not going to want to change radically what they put out last year, especially at this point. You know, if it turns out, well, yeah, you could have made that contribution, got a full deduction. We just, you know, forgot to tell you that. That'd probably be bad for last year. but we'll just have to see what comes out. But keep your eye on this guidance, especially those of you in the 33, I think it is, states that had pre-existing credit programs that were giving more than 15% credit on contributions to certain charities. You might want to keep your eyes out on what's going on in those programs. The IRS this week announced on their website and in news release 2019-58, issued on the 27th of March, that they are making changes to the employer identification number application process to enhance security. The changes here are pretty straightforward. They're going to require the person listed as the responsible person on the EIN application to possess a Social Security number or an ITIN. They will not accept an EIN for the responsible person. So you can't have an entity as a responsible person. We need a person, and that person has to have an identification number. So if you can't provide that, we're going to have a problem. EINs are no longer going to be allowed for this purpose. Because this is a change in how this works, and because they want to give some time for people to react, this change will not take effect until May the 13th. So we have a little bit over a month before we have to deal with this change. If you've been having entities that were applying for ID numbers, they were using a corporate, let's say, responsible party with an EIN, we're going to have to change that. We're going to have to appoint an individual to be the responsible party. We're going to need to give their Social Security number or ITIN will be required with that. But that's not going to be required till May 13th. So if you have any of those you're getting ready to form and you want to still be able to use that EIN, you need to get it done by May 13th. That's kind of the takeaway from this. The IRS also makes it very clear there's no change for tax professionals acting as third-party designees who are applying for it because you're not the responsible party. So the tax preparer does not have to give his or her Social Security number in order to be the party applying for the ID number, because unless that person is the responsible party, which normally will not be the case. So if that's true, there'll be no change. Just be aware, if you have been using EINs, entities and EINs, as a responsible party when you're applying for new identification numbers, if that's been something like an organization been working with has been doing, gonna have to change that here fairly shortly. So just be aware, the IRS announced this ahead of time, gave you time to get used to how this is going to work. Final development this week, we got some final regulations, Treasury Decision 9853, issued on the 26th of March. And this talks about the dealing with reportable transactions. As you may remember, the reportable transaction rules under Section 6707A. If we have a transaction that either meets a list of criteria found in, you know, found under 6011, or it's been specifically identified as a tax avoidance transaction that is a listed transaction by the IRS, then on every return that affects it, that's affected by this item you've invested in, your transaction you've taken part in, you have to attach a Form 8886 Reportable Transaction Disclosure Statement. That has to be attached to the current return. And like if you carry back an NOL, you know, back when we could carry back NOLs, you would have to, you know, attach a copy to that to your carrybacks. You would have to attach it if, let's say, benefits are carrying forward or things are impacting in future years. You'd have to put the 8886 on every return that is impacted by that transaction in whatever fashion it's impacted. If you fail to do that, then there was a penalty. Now, prior to 2010, that penalty was a very nasty fixed dollar amount. Congress in 2010 decided to change that. And what they have now is the penalty is, right, going to be 75% of the decrease in tax shown on the return as a result of such transaction, right? Or would have resulted from such transaction if it had been in respect to federal tax purposes. We do not care, absolutely do not care, whether or not the transaction actually stands up and where the transaction, you know, maybe the transaction is found to be fully fine. It's okay. It's great. The deduction is fully allowed. You're still subject to this penalty if you didn't put this report on. And by the way, the statute doesn't close on the years that this, for the impact of this on any year until that notice is filed and 3 years from that date. So we have that. If you invest in one of these after, let's say you invest in one of these, and then a year later, the IRS puts it out as a listed transaction, you have to go back within a very short time period and file a notice with the IRS indicating that, yeah, you know, my 2014 return, or my 20, let's say, give one that's still open. My 2015 return was impacted by this reportable transaction. And you have to do that, or you're under the rule that you won't start the statute till 3 years from when you file that. If you file it within the 90-day period, then your statute's still the standard statute. So yeah, if it's a 2015 item, you'd really want to get it within 90 days right now, because you obviously don't want the statute to be extended based on that rule. So the IRS issued that. So because of the 75% rule, there also is a, now the new maximum penalty is $100,000 for an individual, $200,000 for other entities if it's a listed transaction, or $10,000 for an individual and $50,000 for other entities for any other reportable transaction. So 75% up to that maximum. There's also a minimum penalty of $5,000 for an individual and $10,000 for any other type of taxpayer. So you have a min penalty, max penalty, and the 75% in the middle. That's where we go. Now, this regulation made very clear that the penalty applies separately for each year. So, you know, the maximums and minimums. If you have a transaction that affects 4 years, your maximum penalty is not $100,000 in total. Your maximum penalty is $400,000 because each one of the years stands on its own. But the IRS did give us some relief. If the IRS publishes something today that says some transaction you entered into, let's say 2 years ago, was a listed transaction, and it has, or let's say you actually entered into that transaction like 5 years ago. So most of the returns impacted by that transaction are now closed. If at the time it becomes a listed transaction, at the time the IRS sets out the notice, if that tax year has closed for IRS assessments, then we don't have to file the 8886. In essence, it doesn't magically reopen. However, if it's open, apparently at the date they issue the listed transaction notice, if it's open at that date, not the 90 days later that you have to file it, but at that date, then you have to file it or the statute's not going to close. So be aware of that. It does make it a little bit simpler. It does mean we don't have to dig back 30 years to find things maybe that could have been impacted by some transaction, but yeah. You know, it does give us some guidance that's out there. Please remember that the 8886 listed transaction rules. Remember, the key thing about those rules is, first thing is you got to check the listed transaction list on the IRS website to make sure your client has not engaged in one. But then secondly, you have to remember that if you don't file this form, the penalty is automatic. And more to the point, the statute stays open on this forever. At least it stays open until you file and then 3 years after you file. So if your client has not filed this, you're just trying to hide, you're going to have to stay hidden for a long time, shall we say. Probably not the best strategy overall, because I don't expect to be much sympathy if it appears you've been trying to hide. Well, as always, this is the time of year we're working on what we've learned during the year in our courses. The courses are coming up. The state societies should be publishing on their websites and getting printed catalogs ready. And you should be seeing what's going to be offered in the coming year. You can take a look there, see what's coming up, see how things work. I'll be in various locations around the country this year. As I said, I'm going to start in Atlanta at their industry conference on the 24th of April. I'll be doing some sessions there on tax updates for industry, some tax issues for industry, including the Cap A rules and looking at what's just basically been tax developments this year. Be a lot, probably a lot of talk there in industry. Want to have some talk about 163J and some of those things on the interest rules. But I'll be doing other courses throughout the year. I'll be in various locations during the year. I know I've got locations booked already. I know I've been told already I'm going to be going to New Jersey for the New Jersey Society. I'll be doing some work in various other locations around the country. Obviously, in Arizona here, I'll be doing work. Be in Idaho later in the year. I'll be in various locales. We'll probably be doing some webcasts, too. We'll see how that works. Got a couple of them tentatively set up for a couple of state societies, so we'll see how that works. And we'll be doing other things, so just check. Your sign-up times are coming. Your state societies will be delivering that information to you. And take a look. We certainly would love for you to select courses that those of us here at Kaplan are involved in. But again, whatever you've got, take a look and get your training for the coming year. Lots of interesting things. Look, we have not got all of TCJ sorted out at this point. There's a whole bunch of things that need to be done. There's a whole bunch of things that have happened just during the time we've been trying to do these returns that we need to get up to date on. So kind of nice to get all that scheduled and working, and maybe you want to consider getting some earlier this year, because like if you didn't go over 199 Cap A after the final regs came out, might not be a bad idea to try to go over 109 cap A and what the final regs mean before you try to finish up all those final, all those extended returns. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of April the 1st, 2019, and nothing in here was an April Fool's joke. Good news. You can catch us online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We'll write our updates during the week about things that happen. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at edzollers is where you'll find me. And I also follow discussions on the subreddit /r/taxpros on Reddit. And as I note always, I follow four state society discussion groups, the California group at Tax Talk, Yahoo Group's Tax Talk, that's open to pretty much any CPA or attorney anywhere in the country. You've just got to go to Yahoo Groups, search for the Tax Talk group, and then ask for admission to come in and to be part of that group. Also, I am members of three state societies and I follow their discussions. I'm a member of the Arizona Society of CPAs, follow their Connect group, follow the Connect groups in Minnesota and in New Jersey. So if you're in any of those locations, you can catch me there. And otherwise, hopefully your tax season is going good. We're here now, and it's kind of like the push just before you do all your extensions. So we get all that fun stuff going on, and all those wonderful clients this year who claim they don't want to go on extension, that those discussions all come up this week. I'm sure you're looking forward to those. And we'll be back next week. I will talk to you then. We talk to you about the things that have happened currently in the area of federal taxes.